In our study last time, we were looking at the latter end of Romans 8:28, where God works everything together for the good of those who are the called according to purpose. And in that study, we zeroed in on the fact that the called are a class of individuals that God has summoned, and he has done that because he has purposes in mind with staggered understanding of purpose. He has a final purpose in mind, but he has all these other purposes that lead to that. And his ultimate purpose, as we've said over and over and over, is to share his life with those who trust him. But that's the big umbrella, the promise of eternal life. Underneath that are many, many lesser purposes, but he calls us according to purpose so that we understand that he doesn't do anything without intention. And of course, in a sense, nobody does anything without intention. Every action is deliberately taken. It might not be consciously deliberate, but it is a deliberately taken action. And the issue there is that what Paul is trying to get us to see is that God has a plan, a purpose, and he is working everything together in that direction, and it is good for those who love him and are the called according to purpose. Now, the reason that he declares this is because Romans 8 is dealing with the ministry of the Spirit of God to us and how we're supposed to relate to him to live, as opposed to misunderstanding grace in chapter 6 and misunderstanding law in chapter 7. The whole point is that he wants us to live confidently in hope because of the Spirit's ministry on our behalf, and he already told us in verse 26 and 27 that one of the big issues of the Spirit's ministry to us is intercessory prayer to God based on what the Spirit sees as the real deep-seated diseases of our souls and spirits. And the Father sees that, and he hears the unuttered groanings of the Spirit and responds accordingly. Now, this whole issue of the Spirit praying and the Father answering and the ambiguities that are existing in our thought because of the fact that the New Testament is full of situations where believers are doing things that they ought not to be doing, and you're wondering, now, if the Holy Spirit's praying for them, how come they're doing that? And all of the vagaries that are involved in the fact that God is dealing with human beings. He's dealing with persons who have a capacity to think and a capacity to make choices and a capacity to feel feelings, and they get all those things sometimes balled up in their doings, and as a consequence, they end up doing a lot of things that aren't smart or wise or loving or anything. But if you get tangled up in all that stuff, in a little while your hope is gone. Because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at himself in the mirror and see if there's any integrity or honesty there, that he doesn't have the ability to make good choices all the time and to do the right thing when the cost is real heavy and all that kind of thing. So we're real needy in terms of being able to be confident that God is in control of this stuff and he is working for our good as believers. Now, this is a critical issue in verse 28 of understanding and believing that everything that happens to us as a child of God who loves him because we've been loved by him first and who has been subjected to the summons of God because God has a purpose in mind for us, all of that hinges on the question of whether we really believe that all of this stuff is working together for our good. Because the greatest difficulty that anybody faces is when life just falls apart, everything is a mess, and painful and disappointing and all of those things. That's when people begin to wonder what in the world's going on. Nobody wonders what's going on when they're healthy and wealthy and doing whatever they please. The only wonder what's going on when it all falls apart. And Romans 8:28 wasn't written for the good times. It was written for the bad times. And so he's trying to get us to believe this, that even the bad things that happen to us, regardless of whether we caused them or somebody else did, is being worked together for our good by an omniscient, loving, powerful God who has made himself our Father and has summoned us into his kingdom and glory. That is a very critical thing for us to believe, and therefore, in verse 29, he uses the word for to begin his buttressing certain truths that will enable us to understand that God is working everything together for good for those who love him and are called according to purpose. And that word translated for in verse 29 is hati. It typically means because. It's a causal conjunction that indicates that there are certain causes that are going to be explained that make what was going before stand out as honestly true. This is believable because. And the thing that is needing to be believed is that everything is working together for our good. And the becauses, actually, verses 29 and 30, there are five becauses. Because God foreknew, because God predestined, because God called, because God justified, and because God glorified. Those are the five things that make it possible for us to understand that God is working together everything. So this causal conjunction, because, introduces these causes, and it means that we're going to be presented with certain linked concepts that build a certain kind of knowledge so that we can believe that everything is working together for our good. So, I want us to think, first of all, not just about the linkage between verse 28 and verses 29 and 30, that there is this truth that needs to be clear and believed, and then the reasons for the faith. Not only that, but the structure in verses 29 and 30, I think, is significant because there are presented in those two verses five actions of God that underwrite the reality of the inevitable good. One of them is that God foreknew, then he predestined, then he called, then he justified, then he glorified. And in the center of the five is the middle one, called. So, the point is, he's been talking about being called. That's the whole issue at the end of verse 28. He also has been talking in many places about this issue of the calling of God and the reason that we've been called to hope and all of those kind of things. Right in the middle of the five things that God has done is this issue of calling. And that kind of makes it the point where you have God foreknew, God predestined, God called. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he glorified. So right there in the middle of that five-fold thing is this issue of the called, for whom all things are working together for good. So the whole point here is actually raised in verse 31 when he says, what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? That God is for us is proven by foreknowledge, predestination, calling, justification, glorification. What shall we say to these things? God is for us. Who can be against us? And then the triumphal issues in verses 31 and following. So, this is the structural issue where calling is being emphasized because it is to the call that all things work together for good. It is because we're called that we love God. So, all of verse 28 is wrapped up in this calling thing. So, I want us to think about the elements of the concept of calling in regard to these things. And we're not going to get past more than one of them this evening. But nonetheless, the issue of being called is at root simply God issuing a summons to a person at a point in time with an undeniable conviction that it is God who's issuing the summons. Now, how God does that varies. But when God calls somebody, they know that it's God. That does not mean that they will respond like they ought to as the creatures of God, because there are many that are called, but not all of them respond positively. We've mentioned that a couple times in our former study. We've seen that Paul talks about the ability to frustrate the grace of God, we see that Jesus says many are called but few are chosen. The idea that God speaks to people with a sufficient conviction that they know that it's God, but without sufficient conviction to bowl them over, overwhelm them. Because God bowls and overwhelms those that are involved in the purpose. But that doesn't mean he never calls anybody else. He does. He extends the invitation. But God, like everybody else that we know as a thinking, rational being, has multiple desires and exercises himself in their regard to some degree, but he doesn't force the issue across the board. And we used the illustration of Paul's statement in 1 Timothy 2 that God is willing for all men to be saved, but it is obviously got to be somewhat limited in his application of power to the willingness, because, quite frankly, God, as an omniscient, omniwise, omnipotent being, could obviously save anybody he wanted to. If the want to was backed by the omnis. But there are more people that are lost than are saved. Jesus said the way to destruction was a wide gate, and many go there, and the way to life was narrow, and few find it. And he is insisting by that, that God is willing for all men to be saved. He will never turn anybody away who calls on him, because Jesus said, he that comes to me I will in no wise cast out. Whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. The invitation's there. The willingness of God to save is there. The problem is that men are caught in this issue of their own depravity and in their antagonism and hatred toward God, which Romans 8 said, the mind set on the flesh is at war with God. In that kind of a setting, there are many who hear from God and turn away because they don't want to hear from God. They despise him. They think evil things about him, and as a consequence, are afraid of him. So when we talk about being summoned, we're just talking about God issuing a call with a conviction that it's him that's doing the calling. But when God issues a call, and in this text, verses 29 and 30, it's obviously an insistent call, because he says, those he called, he also justified. Which means that in the case of the call to verse 28, there's enough punch behind it to make it effective. It's like God calling all of the Pharisees who were involved in the stoning of Stephen, because the calling was a demonstration of Stephen's faith while they were killing him, and his lack of antagonism toward them, and his statement that he sees the Son of God on his right hand, and that kind of thing, and saying, Lord, don't lay this sin to their account. That was one of the things that got to Paul, so that when God summoned him on the road to Damascus, he was bowled over by the reality of the things that had been building in the past that made him uncomfortable with his theology. The greatest discomfort was when he actually was confronted by the Shekinah, and Jesus says, why are you persecuting me? But there were all those others that saw and heard the exact same things at the stoning of Stephen, but they didn't hear, they didn't get the Shekinah glory calling on the road to Damascus. All that means is, sometimes God just steamrolls over people's objections because he has already decided that they are going to be objects of his mercy and grace, and they have nothing more to say about it. I don't want to go talk to him. I've heard many bad things about him. Well, you go talk to him anyway, because he's a chosen vessel of mine, and I'm going to send him to the nations. That's what God told Ananias to tell Paul. You're God's chosen vessel. He didn't ask him. He didn't ask for volunteers. He just did it. So in this calling, the whole point is that God has summoned people into the place of blessing, so that he can work all things together for their good. And God doesn't issue this call out of a vacuum. The first thing he tells us in relation to this issue of the called according to purpose is, because whom he foreknew, he also predestined. And whom he predestined, he called. So there is this issue of the foreknowledge thing, and that's where we're going to camp from now till the end of our study this evening. I'd like to say this about foreknowledge to start with. It is an anthropomorphic statement. Technically, from what we know about God in terms of what the Bible has said and some rational thinking, there is no such thing as foreknowledge with God, because the scriptures declare that there is nothing that God doesn't know. He's omniscient. And in the omniscience of God, there is no such thing as knowledge that's ahead of other knowledge. Now, we can't understand that. Omniscience is as big a mystery to human beings as are all the other attributes of God, because we are time-bound creatures with limited brain capacity and limited focal ability. God has none of those. God is not subject to time, or time would be God. God is outside of time, and we don't understand that at all. Because in our thinking about time, there is this inherent connection to time and succession of events. So that it is the succession of events that cause the passing of time. Or time goes and the events fall into their successions. With God, that's apparently not the case. He just knows everything instantly, always. There's nothing he doesn't know, and there's nothing he foreknows in the sense that there's any kind of knowledge that's before other knowledge with God. I think the biggest problem there is that with human beings, we cannot think of more than two or three things at a time. Most of us can't really focus on more than one thing at a time. And therefore, our brains are kind of like filing cabinets, where we're focused on something and we go to the filing cabinet and pull something out in order to think about that in relation to this thing we're focused on. And it's, you know, it's kind of like a computer where we build these computers after our own model, where it's on the hard drive, but it's not there on the screen until you pull it up there. Well, that's the way we are. But that's apparently not how God is. Apparently God is constantly totally focused on everything that is. And that's one of the remarkable things about the death of Jesus, because before Jesus ever submitted himself to the issue of death, he knew that he would never escape what happened at Calvary. He would never be able to be unfocused about that. And that's part of the reason why his death wasn't just a, you know, 3-hour suffering thing and then dying and then come back to life in 3 days, which a lot of people just kind of blow off as not a big deal. But it probably is a humongous big deal, since Jesus can't get away from what happened there. The Father and him, the split that occurred in the divine nature, death invading life. But be that as it may be, the issue is, foreknowledge is a human concept to explain some things that we have a little trouble with. And one of the big problems we have is that our concept of foreknowledge is unbiblical in many cases. Let me ask you to turn to Acts 26:5 and look at what Acts 26:5 says in the midst of Paul's defense of himself. He is standing before the judicial authorities. Agrippa gives Paul the opportunity to speak in verse 1. And so he begins to speak in verses 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and so on. And he's talking about being accused by the Jews, and how glad he is that Agrippa is the one he's defending himself before, because he knows with some detail the customs and questions that are among the Jews. And so he just asks him at the end of verse 3, "I beg you to listen to me patiently. So then, all the Jews know my manner of life from my youth up, which from the beginning was spent among my own nation at Jerusalem, since they have known about me for a long time, previously, if they're willing to testify, that I lived as a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of our religion, and I'm now standing trial for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers. The issue of verse 5 is that the word that's translated have known is exactly the same word that's used in Romans 8:29. They have foreknown me. Well, what does that mean? When we think of foreknowledge, we're not thinking like that. When I think of foreknowledge in the general context of Bible stuff, I'm thinking about somebody that knows something that's going to happen before it happens. And it's kind of like a prophet who says, this is the way it's going to be, and down the road it pans out that way. And it's rooted in the fact that the prophet knew and declared before it happened that it was going to happen. But that's not what's being said in verse 5, Acts 26. What he's saying is, those people foreknew me. In other words, they knew me a long time ago, before, now. In other words, the meaning of the word is simply to know somebody or something before the present time. They knew me back then, and if they're willing to testify, they'll tell you that I was a Pharisee and so on, so on, so on. So our word, foreknowledge, kind of gets hung up theologically to start with in the idea that we're jumping over the fact that the word itself only means that you knew somebody before the present time, or you knew something before the present time. It's not foreknowledge in the sense that nobody else knew it. It's just foreknowledge because it was in the past. It was before now. And the same thing is found in 2 Peter 3:17. Because in 2 Peter, Peter has written to his audience, and he has said in verse 17 of chapter 3, you therefore, beloved, knowing this beforehand, that's the same verb, knowing this beforehand, be on your guard, lest being carried away by the error of unprincipled men, you fall from your own steadfastness. Now, he is talking about this, that they now know ahead of the time. Ahead of what time? Well, when it actually comes to pass. He has said, I've told you now, so that now you know before the events are going to take place, so that when they take place, you won't be shaken from your steadfastness. In other words, you can say, when it happens, well, Peter told us this was going to happen. If the disciples had locked into what Jesus told them on their way to Jerusalem, that the Son of Man was going to be delivered up and crucified, and then 3 days he would rise from the dead, they knew beforehand. They knew that Jesus was going to be crucified, and if they'd have given it some confidence, they would have known that he was also going to be raised from the dead in 3 days. They heard the crucified stuff and bought into that. Well, let's go be crucified with him. But they heard the other part about him being raised from the third day and blew that off as if it was a myth. But it's not that they didn't hear it, and it's not that they didn't know it beforehand. It's just they blew it off. Well, Peter said, look, I've told you some things that are going to come to pass, and I've told you ahead of time, so that when they come to pass, you won't blow it off. You'll remain steadfast. So the word that's translated foreknow simply means to know something ahead of the present or ahead of the time when it's going to happen. And it doesn't necessarily require prophetic understanding or any of that kind of thing. It's just knowing something before the present. However, there is this issue of clearly recognizing that in order to be able to know things that are going to happen before they come to pass, sometimes that requires some revelation from some omniscient God. Because the things that are being declared that are going to come, you wouldn't be able to say, well, I'm telling you now, so when it happens, you'll know. How can you tell me this unless God has shown it to you, unless God has revealed something ahead of time? That's prophetic. And quite frankly, all prophecy and every promise ever made was rooted in the fact that you were told ahead of time before the fulfillment time. And that's critical. Because in Isaiah, one of the big issues in Isaiah is the question of which God are we supposed to believe? And Isaiah's apologetic is, it shows up in Isaiah 46:10, but it shows up in other places too. And his apologetic is this. If there is an individual who can tell you now or before something ever gets started how it's going to work out at the end, if he can tell you the end from the beginning, then you know you're dealing with God. Because there's only one kind of person who can tell you the end from the beginning, and that is the person who has omniscience. If in Genesis 3, God can say that the seed of the woman will bruise the head of the serpent, and then he waits 4,000 years to do the bruising, most of the people who lived during that time are going to have already blown that off because they only lived 70, 80 years. Of course, from Genesis 3, some of them lived almost 1,000 years, but shortly after the flood, the lifespan started falling off until you're locked into about 70 or 80 years. Well, if the thing that was declared is going to be, but it's not going to be in your lifetime or the next guy's lifetime or the one after that either, I mean, if 4,000 years have to go by, you're already into Peter's thing about people saying, well, where's the promise of his coming? It's been made, you know, the promise has been around all this time and nothing's happened. It's not going to happen. That's the mistake. You can say, you know, the promise was given, everything's running along, hadn't come to pass. You can say all that, but you can't say it's not going to happen. Unless you're omniscient. And we're not. So Isaiah's apologetic was, look, you want to know who the true God is, all you have to do is find the God who is the God of prophecy, who can tell you ahead of time how something's going to play out. And the more specific the declaration is, the more confidence you can have. And so Psalm 22, the prophecies are made about the Christ, his hands and feet being pierced, his bones showing. That's the, my God, how hast thou forsaken me, Psalm. It starts out that way. And Jesus cries out those words because they can see the fulfillment of the prophecy and they can see it in so much detail. They can see the people gambling over his garments. They can see his body stretched out where his bones are showing. They can see the piercing of his hands and his feet. They can see the scoffers going by wagging their heads and you know, mocking and all that. They can see all this. And so they say, well, that psalm was written 1,000 years ago, and here it is being fulfilled in our very eyes. So the author of it must be true. So that's the apologetic that identifies the God. And it's interesting that in Romans 8, 28, it's we know that the God works all things together for good for those who love the God. Because that's the issue even in first century Rome. Most people are polytheistic. They've got lots of gods. There are as many religions then as there are now with some variations. But the fact is, you still got to ask, who do we believe here? Which one is the true one? And Paul introduces foreknowledge in verse 29 because it is the apologetic of the Old Testament. God declares ahead of time what's going to be so that when it comes to pass, you can say, well, that must be the word of God. And since that validates it, from then on, you can have confidence in whatever he tells you. So even though the word foreknowledge doesn't require prophetic, omniscient prior knowledge, it can be something that they knew Paul back when, before the present time that he's before Agrippa. So he can use the word there. Peter tells them now, so that when the things develop, they can say, well, he told us back then, we've known this because he told us, so now we can be steadfast. That's the way it's used in those places, but in this text, the issue is that the foreknowledge comes down to individuals because it's whom he foreknew. And that brings up another issue. Well, let me say a couple other things before we get into that. I just want to say that of all the issues of any kind of relationship with God, they have to start with being able to identify the God. in the midst of the messiness of many who claim to be. In other words, you can't have a relationship with the true God of heaven until you decide which one is the true God of heaven. If you believe Allah is the true God of heaven, you can't have a relationship with the Christian God. If you believe that Buddha is the true God, you can't have a relationship with the Father Jesus Christ. If you believe that the Father Jesus Christ is the true God, then you can't have a relationship with any other of the deities, because they're not deities. You got to decide. That's the issue. And so Paul is saying, look, if you want to believe, or if you can believe, or if you ought to believe that all things are being worked together for your good because you love the God, the true God, you got to start with something that makes it impossible for God to be wrong, and that is for those whom he foreknew. So foreknowledge comes right into play with the issue of being able to be confident. And so the foreknowing of the call means that God has begun something that will end according to what he said, and that is everything works out together for good. Will you see the good while it's being worked? No. You're in the midst of a mess. That's why the verse was given. But will you see that it worked together for your good downrange? Well, yeah, because this is the word of the omniscient foreknowing God. He knows, and he has declared, I am going to do this thing. I'm going to make everything work together for your good. And there will come a day when you will say, that was absolutely true. And Paul says, because that's going to come, I want you to say it now. It's true now. It is working together for your good, regardless of what it is. Because then that will give you hope. You'll see that light at the end of the tunnel, and you'll be able to live in hope by faith. So, to be confident in the face of many things that are significantly unpleasant, believers have to begin where God does, and by prophecy and promise, God reveals to those who believe that he is the God, who can tell the end from the beginning, and he declares that the end will be good. And since Romans 8 has this strong focus on hope, this is the beginning of the stabilizing force for believers. It's imperative that we know that God has always known and that he's working on our behalf. So, let's just think a little bit more deeply about this foreknowledge thing because of the way the word is formed and the way it's used. It's more profound than simply knowing the future before it is the present. The word that's translated foreknow is a combination word that takes the preposition before and one of the verbs for to know. But the verb that he chose to use is the gnosko word, which is the kind of knowledge that's relationally interactive and it's rooted in experience. It's the word that is commonly referred to when a man knows his wife and she becomes pregnant. This is a kind of very detailed knowledge at the physical level, and it results in something, pregnancy and a child. The whole idea there is that this knowledge is experience related, it's relationally related, it's connected that way. And that's typically the way the word is used, and it's the reason why, for example, in Jesus' statement, depart from me, I never knew you, he uses the word gnosko. He's not saying he didn't know everything about them, but he is saying, I never had a relationship of interaction, a positive, healthy relationship with you. You did all these things in my name, but you did it by keeping me at a distance because you didn't want to have anything really to do with me. You just wanted to be able to exercise this power in my name. Get out of here. I didn't ever know you. So that's the beginning of our questions about God knowing. Because the whole point is that the foreknowing by God is a knowing, experience-based, relational kind of knowing with people who didn't even exist yet. When he says that everything is working together for the called, according to purpose, he is saying that God foreknew people on an experientially based basis. They haven't begun to exist yet. And that's a real problem, at least at the beginning of our thinking, because how do you have a relationally interactive basis for knowing somebody when that person doesn't even exist? But I think there are two biblical arguments to weaken the strength of the problem. One of them is Revelation 17:8. Because in Revelation 17:8, there is described a group of people who refuse to be overwhelmed by the Antichrist. And the reason they refuse is not because they're smarter or more godly or any of that kind. The reason given is that they're not deceived because their names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life from the foundation of the world. Okay? Revelation 17:8 is just as clear as a bell that your name and my name was written into the Book of Life of the Lamb from the foundation of the world. Which means that you and I existed in some way before the foundation of the world. And it's not like those people who believe that we were spirit beings and then when two human beings created a body, then this spirit being came and got into that body and then became this human person. And that's not it. But the fact that God could write your name down before you ever even existed implies not only foreknowledge, but it implies a level of understanding because he gave you your name. How did he talk your mom and dad into giving you the name that he wanted you to have? He didn't even have to worry about that. It was going to happen because it was a part of what he knew, foreknew. And the point there is that naming somebody is a relationally significant action. And in the scriptures, when somebody was named, they typically were named because it defined their, it characterized them as an individual. Jesus was to be named Jesus because he was going to be the Savior of his people. Joshua, Jesus, the word means the one who makes a broad place. He's the Savior. John was to be named John because he was going to introduce the truth that Yahweh was gracious to the nation. The reasons for the names are given because they characterize the individual in some way. Cain was called the striker because he was going to strike his brother. His mom and dad didn't know that the striker was going to smite his own brother, but they named him the striker, Cain. That's just the way the names in the Old Testament were presented. Name him this, and then this happens, and it shows that the name was legitimate. Even the name Methuselah, some have argued, meant when he dies, it shall come. And the it is the flood, and he died the year of the flood. Interesting question is, did he die because he drowned? Which is probably not. Point is, God has declared this name thing in Revelation 17:8 for you and me. And that declares that God has a knowledge of in some way, an interactive experience-based knowledge that leaves us scratching our heads. How can that be? But the other one is the other text is Romans 4:17. I said there are two biblical arguments to weaken the strength of the idea that you can't have a relationship with somebody that doesn't exist. Well, Revelation 17:8 says you can declare the names of those that are going to be existing if you're the omniscient God. But Romans 4:17 point blankly says that the issues of faith rest in the characterization of God that he is the one who calls things that are not as though they are. So the quote that is given in Romans 4 in the context is, a father of many nations, I have made you. Perfect tense. Past tense, done deal. How many children did Abraham have when God said that? None. So, he calls the things that are not as though they were. And suddenly sooner or later, they are. Which implies the foreknowledge issue is very precise, very clear, and even borders on being relationally interactive. I've made you the father of many nations. It's a done deal. I don't have any kids. I don't care. It's a done deal. And in that context of Romans 4, that done deal business with God calling things that are not as though they were, he calls us righteous before we are glorified, before we are fully sanctified. He calls us righteous, calls us what is not true yet. But he also says that this is all rooted in the fact that God has done it this way so that it can be by faith, so that it can be by grace, so that the promise can be sure. Now, the logic there is that God has made this declaration ahead of time to be believed, and then the outcome of the believing will result in God calling things that are not as though they were, and it'll be by grace because that's the only way he can make his promises stick. As if he, when he makes the promise, he is actually declaring, I am going to make history work so that this promise will stand. Anybody who believes this promise, which is a before history works it out, anyone who believes this promise will not be ashamed at the end of the history. It will have proven to be a statement of omniscience and commitment on God's part. So when he promises you eternal life, you believe him, you get it. Sooner or later, in all of its fullness. So the whole point there is that in some way, God experiences what is not as though it already is in human history. And in a very real sense, prophecy is simply history before it's happened. It's a declaration of history that's going to happen exactly the way it's said. And that indicates that God is outside of time, outside of his creation. He is declaring his knowledge of us in foreknowledge. So the point is, we get our confidence that everything will work together for good if we're willing to start with the God who is identified by his ability to declare the end from the beginning, and with his omniscience, so that he can say ahead of time, I'm going to turn this into good for you. Period. Don't worry about it. It's going to happen. I'm going to do it. So that's why Paul says, all things work together for good for those who are the called, because the called were foreknown. And in that foreknowledge, God has established the fact that he knows exactly how it's going to turn out.